That's right. First, I would like to thank the organizers for organizing this great meeting. Right, so I'm going to give some rather broad overview of work I've been doing in the past year, more or less, together with Mike Douglas, Bogdan Floria, Antonella Grassi, Shemit Kachru, also with Bobby Acharya and Roberto Valandro. So I won't get into many details. There will be talks by Bobby and by Bogdan that will go, you know, significantly deeper into some of the topics I'm going to talk about. Anyway, so the outline of my talk will be, well, first I give a rather, will give a rather long introduction, you know, sort of defining in a vague way what we mean by the landscape, and addressing the question on how we should study it, what, you know, we can do with the present state of knowledge of string theory, and how we can make progress. And I will also, you know, stress the power on one hand, and also the disadvantages or the, you know, pitfalls of statistics on the other hand. Okay. So basically, this question, what can we do, will, you know, consist of two parts: one, explicit construction of vacua, and the other one is, you know, some sort of statistics of vacua. And I will have something to say about both. So the first one, I'll outline the construction of a completely explicit model with all moduli stabilized. And the second one, I'll summarize results obtained about statistics of vacua. So we'll give my, start with my favorite toy model, you know, giving you some, showing you some detail how calculations are done in this framework, actually. Then I'll give sort of the outline of the general principle how calculations can be done in this setting quite generally. And I'll end with a summary of the results we obtained in this way. Okay, so, well, the string theory landscape, you know, it's something that's not entirely well defined. So the vague idea is there's some huge configuration space in string theory on which, you know, there's some sort of effective potential, of which the minima then somehow correspond to the different possible vacua of the theory, right? So, well, even though it may on itself not be entirely precisely defined, it's clear that, you know, many, many vacua exist. I mean, for one, if you want to play it really conservatively, you know, there are all these well-controlled supersymmetric vacua, which, for some of which we even have a non-perturbative description, like ADS5 times 5 and so on. So it's clearly tons of them. We clearly don't live in the, you know, well, the majority at least of these well-controlled supersymmetric ones don't look at all like our universe and so on. So in any case, I mean, it's clear that there's, you know, something huge out there, and well, we would like to study it somehow. So this landscape is sort of vaguely similar to the energy landscapes in, for example, quantitative biology in problems of protein folding. This is some nice artist conception of some protein folding landscape that I ripped off from some website. So that's of course a nice pictorial analogy, but it you know, doesn't really hold very well. So in, of course, you know, in the context of protein folding, we basically know everything of the underlying dynamics that needs to be known, whereas in string theory, well, you know, well, for example, it's not that clear what the proper degrees of freedom are to take into account in, you know, considering the potential on the dynamics, you know, on this landscape is also not very clear. Especially in a cosmological setting, right, where initial conditions and so on would be very important. And related to that, you know, well, if you sort of want to start thinking about populating the landscape, well, you need some a priori probability distribution for which, you know, you would sort of have to know much more about all these things here than we currently know. So, well, given these, you know, given this incompleteness in our understanding of string theory, what can we do at this point, you know, apart from, of course, trying to solve these very important and deep problems? Well, there are at least two things we can do at this point. So one is explicit construction of vacua. Yeah. Well, of course, we'd like to have them semi-realistic if possible, but anyway. So the one we will focus on, the one aspect we will focus on in this talk, is construction of vacua without any massless moduli, right, with a cosmological constant, also much less than the Kanizsa-Klein scale. And secondly, what we can do already is study the statistics of vacua. And then we mean, you know, study how our vacua are distributed over parameter space. So I want to stress that what I mean here are number distributions, right? And, you know, there was no probability distribution. So I want to stress this because this is a common misconception. So at this point, what we really can do is compute number distributions. And then, you know, eventually, of course, ideally that would, you know, go into probability distributions, but you would, you know, need more knowledge of the dynamics to do that. But of course, knowledge of the number distributions is an important first step also for that, because then once you know some more intrinsic probabilities, basically what you have to do is multiply the two distributions together and you get a total probability, right? All right, so what are the questions we'll try to, or we can try to address in the program of constructing explicit vacua? So it is, of course, well, what kinds of vacua exist in string theory, right? Like in pure field theory, in principle, there's definitely an infinite number of vacua. The question is, which of those could you get out of string theory? So in particular, interesting question is, of course, can you get a standard model spectrum out of it? Or how generically can you get the standard model spectrum out of it, and so on. What are the supersymmetry breaking mechanisms that arise more or less naturally in string theory, or arise at all in string theory? And then finally, what will be my focus today is, what kind of mechanisms are there in string theory to stabilize massless moduli that, you know, tend to appear in most well-known constructions of string theory vacuum. Okay, so in this context, scenario of Kaczor-Kawas, Linde, and Trivedi is the most promising, at least for stabilization of moduli in a controlled regime, right, a reasonably large volume, with moreover a cosmological constant that is much smaller than the KK scale. So it's of course not difficult to construct vacua without moduli where the cosmological constant equals the KK scale. There's all these Front-Rubin vacua and so on. But for phenomenological reasons, clearly those are not the kind of vacua that we would, you know, want. Okay. So within this KKLT context, it turns out that, you know, really getting all moduli stabilized, that imposes relatively strong topological constraints. And a second but is that for typical models, the computational complexity, you know, of really nailing down an explicit model diverges pretty quickly. You know, typically you get like thousands and thousands of moduli. You would have to choose some fluxes that, you know, lifts these all. So you would have to compute a 5,000 times 5,000 mass matrix, diagonalize that, and show that, you know, all these eigenvalues are non-zero, for example. So in that sense, it would be definitely very useful, of course, to have a simple, explicit example where, you know, at least the existence of this construction is really nailed down. And I'll get to that. Then the other program, the statistics program, well, what are the kind of questions we can try to address there? Well, one more modest one, perhaps, is, or more practical, maybe, is just guidance for model building, right? So, so say that you want to construct a model with certain compactification, certain topology, and you want to obtain certain properties. Well, before you really try to construct something explicitly, you would like to know, you know, if it's going to be possible, right? Or how generic it is, or how, you know, hard you're going to have to look in the, you know, set of all possible fluxes, for example, to get a model that does what you want. And often the statistical approach can give you an answer without, you know, too much effort. So the most extreme case of that is basically, you know, sometimes it's actually possible to do statistical analysis to really exclude certain properties of vacua in a given ensemble. So, for example, typically in flux compactifications, it turns out that large volumes are, you know, suppressed, and moreover that actually there is some maximum volume beyond which you cannot stabilize the moduli. So, of course, that's very useful to know in the thing, you know, if you want to try to construct a large, super large extra dimension compactification or something. Okay. So then you can go on, and you can also ask, well, you know, how fine is, you know, the discretium of parameters space? For example, is it sufficiently fine to accommodate a small cosmological constant in, you know, the sense of Gusow and Polchinski? Or, yeah, the other way around, is it, you know, still sufficiently sparse to be distinguishable by experiments with reasonable accuracy? Those are also broad questions you can try to answer in this framework. Then you can take things a little bit further still and consider these studies as giving some notion of naturalness in string theory. So, for example, you know, given the landscape, you know, is it still reasonable to assume that we need low energy supersymmetry for naturalness, because otherwise the Higgs mass must be fine-tuned? Well, you know, what if it turns out that in this landscape, to get low energy, you need even more fine-tuning, right? So then, you know, this whole naturalness argument sort of does no longer hold. Okay. So in that sense, it's been suggested this landscape, together possibly with environmental selection principles, could, you know, lead to some alternative notion of naturalness, and in a more phenomenological context, this has been pursued by Nima, Harkani Hamet, and Safas Dimopoulos, and collaborators. So, of course, here, you know, you sort of, well, start having to make some hypotheses about relation of, you know, probability distributions to number distributions and so on. So this is one step beyond what I'm actually going to talk today, right? But so eventually that might be the ambition of the whole program. Okay, so a few words about the power of statistics, though. So one thing is that it's, you know, often easier to count vacua than actually to construct vacua. So one analogous situation, I mean, there are many analogous situations, but one is, for example, the construction of zeros of the Riemann zeta function, which is, of course, an outstanding open problem in mathematics. I mean, to prove that, you know, they're all non-real ones are on the axis with real part equals half. But on the other hand, the distributions of these zeros are very well known, so they're like very precise asymptotic expressions for distributions of these zeros in the complex plane. So, you know, that's one example. And then secondly, statistical distributions, or number distributions, sorry, are more robust than individual solutions. So say you work in a certain approximation, neglecting certain corrections, you get some distribution. Now, if you're now going to take into account more corrections, then the individual vacua will typically, you know, their parameters will typically shift, for example, cosmological constants and so on, will shift by a certain amount. But if the original distribution you started with, thus, you know, if the length scale of its variation is sufficiently much larger than the expected scale of the corrections, then the distribution itself will remain roughly unchanged. So in that sense, it's much more robust than constructing individual vacua. Yeah. Okay. On the other hand, of course, just to keep in mind that naive statistics can be misleading. It can be misleading in non-physics slides. It can be misleading here as well. So one example is this well-known, maybe, naive argument for distribution of distributions of supersymmetry breaking scales. So the argument goes as follows. Well, you know, if you look at the supersymmetry breaking parameters in some F supersymmetry breaking scenario, then you might say, well, you know, it's reasonable to assume that these parameters are uniformly and independently distributed, maybe. So if that's the case, you would say, okay, then the number of vacua with supersymmetry breaking parameter f, the length of this vector f, less than some value f star, should be proportional to the volume of a sphere with radius f star. And when there are n moduli, you will therefore get something that grows as f star to the power 2n. Yeah. So in other words, you get a huge suppression of low energy supersymmetry breaking scales. Yeah. Okay. Now, if you continue reasoning like that, it sounds, of course, equally reasonable, you know, if you accept this, equally reasonable that also the superpotential itself and its second derivatives, which basically the fermionic mass matrix, those are also uniformly and independently distributed, and, you know, you could keep on making these assumptions and go on and make further predictions. But these statements here cannot be all right at the same time for the simple reason that W, F, and M are not independent, but they are related by the condition that, you know, you need to be at the critical point of the potential, right? So if you use the usual expression in supergravity for the potential in terms of the superpotential, then you find a relation between these things directly that looks like this, right? So they're definitely not independent, and indeed it turns out that this relation completely changes this conclusion. So I'll get to that further on. Okay. So having said that, let's return to the explicit construction of vacua. So this is work done together with Bogdan Floria, Mike Douglas, Antonella Grassi, and Shamit Kachru. It's her paper of last week. So the problem here is to find a four-dimensional string compactification with a reasonably large volume, with no massless moduli, and, you know, at the first stage at least, n equals 1 unbroken supersymmetry. So this is the problem we set to solve. And the KKLT scenario says that in principle this should be possible by looking at type 2B theory, turning on fluxes, and considering non-perturbative effects, which gives a superpotential that schematically looks like this. So the fluxes induce a superpotential for the dilaton and the complex structures, and the non-perturbative effects induce a superpotential for the Kähler moduli. And so if the superpotential is thus generated is sufficiently rich, you may expect that this will fix all moduli in principle. Now, of course, you would like to see an example of this idea. And it's plausible that there are many, but it turns out that they are, you know, technically quite difficult to construct explicitly. So I did some work with Douglas and Florea to get explicit constructions somewhere last year. But so these models were pretty complicated, and, you know, some aspects of it were just, you know, technically too hard to do explicitly at that point, such as, you know, showing that all the seven brain moduli are really fixed and so on. So we made some progress there now, and we found a very simple example where, you know, everything can really be shown. And this example is nothing but just a Z2 orientifold of a type 2B on the well-known T6 mod Z2 times Z2 resolved. So we first resolved this space with Z2 orientifolded. This gives a nice model, and it turns out that, you know, you can fix all moduli in this model, right? So the orientifold acts in the usual way, and, you know, this model is, of course, very well known. Okay, so a brief summary of the geometry of this model. Bogdan will, you know, tell you much, much more about this. So schematically, in the orbifold limit, you can represent this space in this way, so you get this cube. Every side of the cube represents a T2, if you want. Then the orbifold action has 3 times 16, which is 48 fixed lines, which are these lines. So it's fixed complex lines, right? So these are two real dimensional. And Moreover, the orientifold action then will give an addition of 12 fixed planes, which will correspond to 07 planes, and then 64 fixed points, which correspond to 03 planes. Yeah. This is the 51 tree model. Yeah, so I'll get to that now. So the massless content of this model is as follows. There are three complex structure moduli, just you know, the three T2s that you have. They each have their usual modular parameter, plus the dilaton. Yeah. And then these, you know, 48 fixed lines, we choose to resolve these, and that gives you 48 blow-up modes. So in total, there will be 51 Kaelin moduli. And finally, as I said, there will be 12 07 planes, and we choose to put four coincident D7 brains on top of those, such that the tadpole, the D7 tadpole, is locally cancelled, and also such that you get an SO8 to the 12th gauge theory. And now the crucial thing is that there is no massless matter on these brains. So let me explain this in a bit more detail, because it's very important, of course. So one way to understand this roughly is to just look at the local model of the singularities. So that would be C3 mod Z2 times Z2. So then pictorially what you have is three fixed lines, so you have singularities and then three devices, three surfaces, which meet along these lines. Right, and so these devices here, D1, D2, D3, are the 07 planes, so on which we put the D7 stack, so the gauge theories live on these guys. So a priori you would say, oh, well, you know, these things touch each other, so you should get massless by fundamentals and so on. But by blowing up the singularity, you replace the six lines by new exceptional divisors, and the effect is that the seven brain stacks actually move away from each other. So there are no massless open strings between them, and you lift in this way all masses by fundamental matter. Okay. So, secondly, well, there could, in principle, of course, be masses adjoint matter, but, well, this is not there either for the following reason. So these SO8 stack devices before blowing up have a topology just of T4 mod Z2 times Z2, which is the same as T2 mod Z2 squared, which is P1 times P1, with, you know, singularities. But now you blow up and you see from this picture, from this local picture, that the topology of the devices does not change by blowing up, right? So, you know, in principle, you could have blown up points and so on in the divisor, but these stay exactly the same. So that means after blowing up that these devices still have topology P1 times P1. So that means that H20 of them is zero in particular, and that implies that there is no massless adjoint matter on these brains. So they're completely rigid. Yes. All right. So that brings us then to the problem of fixing the moduli, which, okay, in this setting means finding isolated solutions of dW equals zero. Yeah. So all we have to fix is, well, three complex structure moduli in the dilaton. This we can fix in a well-known way by turning on three-form fluxes, F and H. So no, you know, mystery there. Moreover, the tadpole in this model equals 28, right? Which, so in principle, you could cancel that. So, sorry, that's a D3 brain tadpole. In principle, you cancel that by adding 28 D3 brains in the quotient space, right? But equally well, you could cancel this tadpole by, you know, turning on the fluxes, which we choose to do, such that, you know, you don't have mobile D3 brains, so you don't get moduli from those either. Yep. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, just fluxes Poincaré dual to the you know, flat Lagrangian cycles that you get from the parent T6, basically. Yeah.
So you can actually solve the exact.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So you have to, you know, look a bit in a huge set of possibilities, but you find explicit examples which exactly cancel the tadpole. Yeah. All right. Then more challenging is fixing the Kähler moduli. Yeah, so there are 51 of those. Looks like quite a lot at first. Well, to fix those, you need non-perturbative effects, as I said. And there are two kinds of them. One is Gugino condensation in the effective Super-Young-Mills theories. And the other one is just, you know, stringy Euclidean D3 brain instantons. Yeah. So as I just explained, we don't have any matter in our SO8 gauge series. So you get pure N equals 1 Super-Young-Mills, you get Gugino condensation, and this Gugino condensation will generate a superpotential which depends then on the size of these devices that are wrapped by the seven brains that give the SO8. And then moreover, happily, it turns out that the exceptional devices, remember, that you get from blowing up these fixed lines, that they are automatically rigid, more or less. Or, you know, more precisely, the M-theory lifts of those things have all higher H0, I equals 0. And moreover, well, you know, satisfy other consistency conditions. There's no flux on them, and so on and so on. So as is well known from work by Witten, this means that these things indeed contribute to the superpotential. And you get in this way 48 extra contributions. Okay, and indeed, together it turns out that this is sufficient to stabilize all moduli, as we explicitly verified, at moderately large radii, and it turns out also that the corrections, at least the known corrections, are small at the 1 or at most a few percent level. So let me flash the numerical results. The details are not very important, but just, you know, to show that we worked this out in all detail. So what these graphs show are, well, on the x-axis in each case, it shows basically the logarithm log 10 of the flux contribution to the superpotential. Yeah, so that's, you know, determined first, and the smaller that contribution is, typically the larger the radii become at which your model is stabilized. So these are, you know, various parameters. So here, I mean, the details are not very important, but so T and R, T is basically the blow-up parameters, R are basically the radii of the T2s, the T2 mod T2s that you get from the parent T6. The VD and VE are the sizes of the exceptional divisors, and V here is the total volume. So, you know, depending on how you choose your fluxes, you can get values of log 10 W between, or minus that, between 1 and 4 or something like that. So you get, you know, volumes between 50 and 200 or something like that. So, all right, you know, that's not huge. Well, so you would definitely have to check then if all known corrections are under control, and so, you know, alpha prime corrections, for example. So what is known, for example, is the first alpha prime cube perturbative correction, and there are, you know, can do an estimate of instanton correction, because you see these exceptional curves become pretty small, so you know, have to see if instanton contributions don't give a huge contribution and so on. So we worked all that out, and all, you know, this mass of plots basically give the relative sizes of various corrections to the volume, to the derivatives of the volume. It's also important. And you see that, you know, all these corrections, relative corrections to volume and the derivatives, are all within, you know, the few percent range. Okay, so, well, yes. Well, the No, so that's the thing. So that's, you have to do that at, so if you want to give a consistent orbifold CFD at the orbifold point, you're first to turn on discrete torsion, and which influences the tadpole quite strongly. But at large, so we first, resolve the manifold, and at large radii, you're basically free to, choose discrete torsion or not. And so the idea is that, the case without discrete torsion, if you take the orbifold limit, then you'll get massless states and, tensionless strings and those things. So you just don't get a consistent orbifold description. But at large radii, at sufficiently large radii, you can just use a geometrical description. Yeah. So that's, and then you get a, higher tadpole, so that gives you more leg room. Yeah. Okay. So knowing now that, we can really get these vacuum. That's right. Yeah, that's why you have to, for example, compute this instanton sum of Rothschild instantons wrapping the exceptional curves and so on to see that, you're really in a controlled regime. But it, I guess you're lucky and it turns out to be the case. But, yeah. Okay, so now we can, zoom out and try to determine how all these vacua are distributed over a parameter space. So, of course, this sort of implies some leap of faith, like, just showing that things work in one concrete example doesn't mean that it will work in a huge set of examples. So there's definitely much more work that needs to be done there. But let's assume that this is the case and see what we get then. So to illustrate the kind of computations we do, let me give this toy model, which is essentially you can think of as type 2B on a rigid Calabi-Yau. I've given this toy model a few times before, so some people might already know it, but I think it's gives a pretty neat illustration of the general idea. So in this case, well, you can basically turn on few RR fluxes and SNS fluxes, and this induces a Kugel-Fafa-Witten superpotential that has this form where these Fs and Hs are integers. And tau here, which is in this case, because the Calabi-Yau is rigid, is the only modulus we consider. Tau here denotes the Dilaton axiom. Okay. So moreover, there is a D3 tadpole cancellation condition, which in this case translates to this simple inequality. And this L star here, well, for the toy model, we just take this to be an arbitrary parameter. In more realistic examples, L star will be minus the D3 brain charge, which is induced by the O3s, the O7s, D7s, and so on. Or if you lift this thing to F theory, it's actually equal to minus the order characteristic of the fourfold divided by 24. But anyway, for the toy model, we just take L star to be arbitrary. Okay. So in this case, we can easily write down explicit solutions for DW equals zero. And that's just given by tau equals minus this quotient of complex integers. So with the help of a computer, you can exactly enumerate a vacuum. Of course, a priori, there's an infinite number of them, but you have to mod out by SO2Z duality, right? So which is equivalent to just looking at vacua within one fundamental domain. So with the help of a computer, you can do, construct all of these exactly and count them. And so, for example, when L star equals 150, you get 37,208 vacua. How are they distributed over the moduli space? They are distributed in this pretty way. So, of course, you see there's a pretty interesting, intricate structure. Now, apart from gazing at this picture and admiring its beauty, we would like to more concretely do something with it, and what we would like to do is, given a certain region here, give some approximation for the number of vacua that's in there. Yeah. So how can we do that? Well, okay, so what's the problem? So we need to find a number of vacua satisfying this tadpole constraint in a region R of the moduli space, and the exact number of these vacua is given by this expression. So you sum over all the fluxes that satisfy this constraint, and then this integral here over this region R simply counts the number of solutions of dw equals zero in that region. Right? So the determinant factor here appears to guarantee that each zero of dw contributes exactly one to the integral and not some other number. Okay. Now we switch this integral and the sum, and then here comes the main approximation we make. Instead of summing, we're now going to integrate over the fluxes. Right? So we neglect quantization in this way, which will be a good approximation if the region in flux space we consider is large. Right? Basically, the idea that you can count the number of lattice points in a large region basically by computing the volume. Okay. So, well, how can we compute this integral? So at a fixed value of the modulus tau here, you know, we have to compute this integral, and it's very useful to make a linear change of variables that looks like this. So instead of f and h in R4, we go to w and f, which is dw in C2, which are, you know, physically relevant parameters, of course, but they also turn out to simplify this integral enormously, because it turns out that this tadpole L is just w squared minus f squared. The Jacobian for this change of variables is just 4, and its determinant here turns out to be just equal to absolute value of w squared. So that means you can just plug this in, do the integral, you get some simple finite dimensional integral, and what you get is simply 2 pi L star squared times the area of this region. So I sneaked in this metric factor here. It's because, well, I didn't mention, but the indices here are all orthonormal frame indices, and doing that properly then, you know, just gives you this additional factor of G, right? Which is, of course, also required for diffeomorphism invariants. Anyway, so this is the result, and applying this to our example of star equals 150, you know, you get for the total number of vacua the estimate given here. Plugging this number in, you find 37,011, which is within 0.5% of the exact result. So that's a pretty neat estimate. Okay, so of course this is just a toy model, but actually one thing that turns out to hold also in you know, more general cases is that string coupling constant, which is just 1 over the imaginary part of tau, is estimated to simply distribute it uniformly. So that means that, you know, if you want vacua with string coupling constant less than 1/10, you'll get roughly 1/10 of the vacua. Right? So getting a small string coupling constant is actually not a very not very difficult to achieve. Yeah. And finally, well, some words on, you know, the nature of approximation. I already mentioned this. So what we essentially are doing is, you know, we're going to counting lattice points in flux space by computing the volume of a region. And clearly, you know, this is not going to be a good approximation if this region is very small, which, you know, essentially translates to the fact that in order to trust these approximations, you need that this L star is sufficiently big, which sort of vectorially corresponds to the radius, and then secondly, that the region R that you, you know, integrate over is sufficiently large, which sort of vectorially corresponds to the opening angle. Right, so that's why, you know, you can have these holes and so on. You know, if you look at scales smaller than the holes, of course, you get large fluctuations. But, you know, once you make it a little bit bigger than those, it turns out that the approximation is quite good. All right, so now the general strategy. You know, considering very general ensembles of compactifications, well, usually these come with a large set of discrete data, such as, you know, fluxes, you could think of brain charges, and so on. So this defines an ensemble of effective four-dimensional supergravity Lagrangians with potentials that, you know, look like this. So this label, N is a discrete label, superpotential depends on it, so the potential also depends on it. Define also moduli space M. So for example, in a type 2B flux case, it's just, you know, linear in N times some period factor. And again, the number of metastable vacua can be, you know, written down exactly in this form. So you sum over all discrete data, and then this integral just counts the number of critical points of V, with weight 1. And this here symbolizes the constraint that you only look at vacua which have a positive mass matrix, right? Metastable vacua. So this is what we will have to compute, at least approximately. So how do we do that in practice? Well, again, you can make a change of variables, right? So remember, in the toy model, we changed to W and F. So more generally, there are more degrees of freedom, so you need more variables. And actually, a very natural, physically very natural set is just the different derivatives of the superpotential. So it's, you know, Suzy breaking scale, mass matrix, your color couplings, and so on. Okay? So what's the idea? Well, at some fixed value of the moduli, varying these discrete parameters will define some large discrete set in this space of couplings, W, F, and Y. And the exact distribution of these points will be given by some, you know, discrete measure, which, you know, looks something like that. Okay? Now, to be able to actually do computations, what we would have to do is find some continuous approximation to this distribution and take it from there. So say we have done that, then, So in the type 2B flux case, to give an example, this is actually fairly straightforward to do because, as I said earlier, W in this case is linear in N. So the continuous approximation will be just a uniform distribution, yeah, supported on some linear subspace because everything is linear. Concretely, this looks like that. So you get, you know, basically, these are independent variables. Distribution, you know, the measure is just a translation invariant Lebesgue measure. With then some additional constraint that relates these different parameters that are outlined here. The details are not very important, but so you can use special geometry to nicely relate all these things explicitly. And moreover, again, yeah, also the tadpole constraint also becomes very simple in these variables, right? Okay. So now finally, to get the full vacuum number density, you combine the a priori measure that we had, right, for which we found this, for which you have to find this continuum approximation, d mu 0. You combine that now with this constraint v prime equals 0. Right, and that will give you then some approximate integral for the number of vacua. Right, this measure here looks like, well, combination of the priori measure, integral over the moduli, and then these vacuum constraints. And happily, it turns out that, again, also this V prime, V double prime, and so on, can be expressed completely in terms of W, F, M, and Y, and so on. So again, the details are not very important. I'm just showing this to prove, I guess, that these V prime, V double prime can all be expressed in terms of these parameters. And in other words, that means that once you have this continuum approximation for d mu 0, what you're left with is just a finite dimensional integral, which in principle you can compute. Okay. So that's the general idea. Now let me give some summary of results we obtained. First, for supersymmetric type 2B flux vacua. So here there's a very nice result that goes back already to Ashok and Douglas, saying that the number of flux vacua in a region R of the moduli space is estimated by, or bounded below, more precisely, by this expression. So this is actually counting the number of vacua with signs, so it's some sort of an index. What we have here, R is the curvature on the moduli space, omega is the Kähler form on the moduli space, D3 is the number of tree cycles of the Calabi-Yau, and L star is the D3 tadpole, right, which is determined by the topology of the compactification, right? So this is something you can, you know, compute in principle. It has actually, you know, topological nature, even though computing this thing exactly is a bit more complicated than what you would have to do on compact varieties, right? Because this moduli space is non-compact, has singularities, and so on. But anyway, can definitely be done in a number of cases. Then results on the distributions of supersymmetric cosmological constants. So supersymmetric case is just given by minus 3w squared. Well, it turns out that for small cosmological constants, this distribution is just uniform, right? Which is maybe what you might have expected. On the other hand, you could also have expected naturally that maybe the distribution would not go like dw squared, but more like d absolute value of w or something. So, but our analysis really showed that it's just uniform in the cosmological constant. Moreover, large volumes are strongly suppressed, so I haven't really said anything about the Kähler moduli, but if you add now Kähler moduli and stabilize them, and assume they're stabilized in a KKLT kind of way, well, since you stabilize these with instanton-like contribution to superpotential, which you know, go like e to the minus the volume of some surface, so in other words, e to the minus two-thirds of the volume of the entire KBR, roughly, because of that, you actually well find a distribution that looks like this. So the basic idea is actually very simple. So you get these instanton contributions e to the minus cv to the two-thirds. They have to be of order w flux squared. They balance off against each other, and so then from this distribution, you simply by plugging in this equality, you get this distribution. So in particular, this also means that there will be some maximal volume that will not be very large, at least in supersymmetric case. Okay, and then finally, one other cute result is that vacua turn out to cluster near conifold degenerations. Right? So if T is some modulus that parametrizes how far you are from a conifold degeneration of the Calabi-Yau, you get this distribution, which you know, diverges at t equals zero, but in an integrable way. And this is a nice interpretation in terms of the dual gate theory that exists in that limit. So you basically, you know, these vacua that are in the bulk of the moduli space are just, you know, uniformly spaced, suddenly start to cluster very closely together. So you get some new, very small scale near this conifold point, and that is a reflection, actually, of the scale hierarchy you naturally get in this dual gauge theory, which is asymptotically free. Okay. All right. Then we generalize this, Mike and I, to include non-supersymmetric type 2B flux vacua. And then here, of course, you know, very important question, I guess, or interesting question, is what is the distribution of supersymmetry breaking scales? So if you look at just F-breaking vacua with F much smaller than the fundamental scale, we get, well, for generic vacua, you don't put constraints on the cosmological constant, so generic negative lambda. We get that the number of vacua, or the density, just scales as df, so it's just uniform in F. If, however, we impose constraint on the cosmological constant that it has to be positive or near zero, then we find this distribution, F to the fifth. Yeah. So, well, I cannot go in detail now, but basically the reason is it turns out that, you know, if you impose this further constraint, you have to do a number of additional tunings to actually get metastable vacua there. And this number of additional tunings, well, is essentially 5. That's a rough way of understanding this. So in any case, this shows that, you know, in this setting, that low breaking, that low supersymmetry breaking scale is disfavored, but it's much, much less than what, you know, the naive guess was, right? Remember, I started off with this naive estimate of the number of, naive estimate of a distribution of the supersymmetry breaking scale, which went like d to the f, d of f to the 2n. So it turns out if you do it precisely, you get a much slower growth. But nevertheless, low scale is still disfavored. Okay. Now, on the other hand, there are other types of breaking supersymmetry. So one of them is some sort of Reynolds syndrome, like if you want sort of d-breaking, right? Where you put some entity 3 brain at the bottom of some warped ADS throat near a conifold degeneration. So in that case, the supersymmetry, so this is actually what's used in the original KKLT scenario as well. So in that case, the supersymmetry breaking scale is just given by some power of the distance from the conifold point in complex structure moduli space. Yeah. And so if that's much smaller than the fundamental scale, then you can just get this distribution of supersymmetry breaking scales from the distribution of moduli that I gave earlier. You just plug that in and you get this distribution. So in this case now, you find that distribution is actually peaked at low energy supersymmetry breaking scale. So in this scenario, low energy supersymmetry breaking is favored. So then of course the question is, well, you know, which of these two is going to be more numerous in string theory? So for that you, well, you would have to, you know, probably extend these ensembles to situations where both can occur and then compare the two. Of course here, you know, if you want to push things further and look at probabilities, then things surely will get very complicated here because, you know, these two kinds of vector are quite different. So you might also expect that a priori probabilities would be very different from those. So that's, you know, unfortunately quite, let's call it challenging. Okay. All right. So then finally I'll say something briefly about results we got for G2 flux vacua, so it's together with Bobby Acharya and Roberto Falandro. So he will talk much more about this. Just a few things. So basically we find that the number of flux vacua in a region R of the moduli space of this M-theory convectification looks like this. So it's sort of is reminiscent of what we find in type 2b, only now instead of this L star, there's some other number that appears C2, which is some complex Chern-Simons topological invariant of the specific compactification. Bobby will tell more about that. This, yes. Yeah. Again, you can compute the distribution of that, and you can, you know, make that. So you can make the KK scale, you know, reasonably higher than the ADS scale. So, you know, factor of C2 to some power. So the bigger C2 is, the bigger you can make this scale difference. C2 controls that. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So in this setting, again, large volumes are strongly suppressed. So now instead of this exponential behavior, you find this more polynomial behavior. But if V3, the number of tree cycles, the number of moduli is very large, you see that large volumes will be strongly suppressed. And actually, there will be an upper bound on the volume, which depends again on this C2, which is given by this value. So this is not a very large value if C2 is not huge. So in particular, you know, you're not going to get volumes of millimeter scale or something. Okay. So then for cosmological constants, you can basically, for the distribution of those, you can basically use a distribution of the volumes, because it turns out that in the G2 case here, the cosmological constant is essentially equal to 1 over the volume cubed. And the reason why there's no, you know, further tunability here is because in the G2 case, the number of fluxes equals the number of moduli. And once the moduli are fixed, once the volume is fixed and so on, there's no further tunability. So that sort of fixes the cosmological constant scale in terms of the volume scale. So I'm a bit, you know, like your questions are a bit imprecise here. So it involves also C2 and so on, and indeed the maximum volume that you can get here also depends on C2, so that sort of gives you the maximal scale hierarchy you can get here. Okay. Similarly, for supersymmetry breaking scales, you again find that this, you know, if you now take this to supersymmetry breaking back. You know, you again find that this scale of supersymmetry breaking is essentially fixed by the KK scale, KK scale, KK scale. Yeah, that's right. right, in a very similar way here. So there is some Gaussian-like variance around this, but the essential scale is fixed like that. So you see that, you know, because the large volumes are suppressed, you see that small cosmological constants or small supersymmetry breaking scales will also be suppressed. So in this setting, it's definitely you will not get small F-breaking supersymmetry breaking vacuum. Okay, and so the reason, as I already briefly mentioned, is essentially that in this case there are only as many fluxes as moduli. So all scales are basically set by the values of these moduli, in particular by the volume, and there's no further discrete tuning possible. So this is quite different from the type 2B case, where you have many more fluxes than moduli, and you can, you know, tune to this, get these very small cosmological constants. Right. Okay, so let me give conclusions then. So at least, you know, for the statistics part of the story, we found that the distributions of both supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric vacuum of the moduli space are roughly uniform for all, you know, flux compactification studies thus far, except possibly near singularities. So in type 2B, you find near this conifold singularities pile ups of vacuum, but for the rest, it's basically uniform. Then a universal feature is also that large volumes are strongly suppressed, and that there is typically an upper bound on the volume. Because this also needs to be qualified a bit. I didn't say anything about those things, but in Freund-Rubin vacuum, actually, this turns out not to be the case, but universal vacuum has other problems. I'm sure Bobby will tell you more about that. But anyway, for the more conventional flux vacuum, this is definitely a general feature. Then, as I said in the previous transparency, in the type 2B case, once the volume is fixed, then type 2B still allows other quantities such as lambda and M Suzy to be discretely tuned to much smaller values, which, you know, reflected itself in the results we got. While in the G2 case, that's not the case. So now, of course, you know, you could ask, well, how about duality? Aren't these things supposed to be the same? And in a rough sense, there's some truth in that. So, but the thing is that, you know, many of the fluxes you can turn on in type 2B actually supposedly then are mirror to M-theory compactified not on a G2 manifold, but on, you know, more complicated geometry like some weak G2 or other kinds of deformations. So there's some sort of discrete fluxes there that sort of encode different geometrical deformations. But of course, these are, you know, harder to work with, even though we'll probably hear some progress in these things at this conference. So in principle, of course, you know, there should be many more M-theory vacua that presumably then, even though that's not sure, would allow finer tuning of cosmological constant and so on. But this is, of course, some interesting question that needs to be answered. And then finally, another universal feature is that we find that for F-breaking vacuum, at least, that low-energy supersymmetry breaking is numerically disfavored, definitely, even if you take into account, even though I didn't say anything about that, but it turns out to persist even when you take into account the additional Higgs mass tuning you would have to do, to get small electro weak scale given large supersymmetry breaking scale. Even when taking that into account, you still find that F breaking F breaking vacua disfavor low energy supersymmetry breaking scale. Of course, in this particular D term breaking case, things are different. So that's something that needs to be thought further about. Anyway. That brings us to things that should be clarified in this setting. So one thing is, of course, you know, look at more general ensembles in various contexts. A second thing one thing we definitely haven't done much in is to study, the observable sector, like, how do all these distributions of moduli and so on translate into measurable things. So it will be interesting to combine these semi-realistic B-brain models with this statistical approach to actually, for example, get distributions of your color couplings and so on. So this would, be actually interesting to see if, this whole statistical ideas actually lead to something that is roughly compatible observations, or one might even hope that, you get so outrageously wrong predictions that it must mean that this whole landscape business is completely wrong, which would be a very interesting outcome as well. Then another thing to do is, in the explicit construction program is to establish the existence of more vacua with all moduli stabilized. That would, of course, be interesting. And finally, these questions I started with, like questions about dynamics, how you get true probabilities and so on, that, of course, should be clarified, or maybe some reasonable hypothesis should be proposed and tested and so on. But clearly, still a lot to do. Thank you.